You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is James Corbett, publisher of theCorbettReport.com and editorial writer for the International Forecaster. He's speaking to us from Japan. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you for having me on. A pleasure to be here, as always.
I heard a report that if you want to find a home safe to store your cash in Japan, you can't find one to buy because they've all been snapped up since Japan instituted negative interest rates. Is that true?
Well, I have read the same stories online. I have not yet observed the phenomenon in real life here in Japan, but I am going to take a trip down to the local home center and just inquire as to the availability of safes. I haven't noticed that kind of activity going on right now, and I haven't noticed a lot of people talking too much about what's happening economically here. I think everyone does have the sense that things are not working out, that Abenomics has been a failure, that people are scared about what's happening right now, and certainly the markets are showing that investors are not putting a lot of confidence in this negative interest rate policy move. And we just had Haruhiku Kuroda, the Bank of Japan governor, come out and say he was flummoxed, he was flabbergasted, he doesn't understand why the markets aren't happy about this negative interest rate environment. Well, it's because people are looking for anywhere to put money where they can, you know, store it without being charged for it. The big banks, of course, right now are looking for that safe haven and are flooding to treasuries as usual. And that's why they're pushing the 10-year treasury even more negative right now. So I think that this is gradually seeping down. I'm not sure it's really panic levels yet here amongst the general public, but there may be a kind of avant-garde of people who are keeping their ear to the ground with this type of thing that are interested in ways to store their money outside of the banking system.
And perhaps they ran out of safes because there wasn't a big demand for them for a long time, so why would
that
you have a lot in stock?
Yep.
But if that is the case, would you see home break-ins in Japan break-in? Because I think Japan must have one of the lowest crime rates in the world.
It has to be one of the lowest in the developed world, certainly. And I read a stat recently, just a month or two ago, that crime rates last year dropped again to the lowest point that they have been in the entirety of recorded history post-World War II. So they are at historical lows for a country that already has quite low crime rates. So if there is to be a complete breakdown of society and, you know, marauding bands of people going house to house, you know, Mad Max style, I don't think that's going to be in Japan, first of all. It's still a society that has remarkably little crime. It is interesting, though, I mean, because it is certainly a country that relies on a lot of cash, and people carry a lot of cash around with them, generally speaking. So maybe people are starting to read the handwriting on the wall that, you know, if this really does go south, that nice low crime rate might start to uptick.
Is the Japanese government among those that wants to declare war on cash if people use a lot of cash there?
I'm not getting the same push here as I see happening all around the world right now. There are elements of that here in this country, and there are certainly pushes for various types of electronic payments that are coming in, and a lot of customer loyalty cards and things along those lines that people tend to use because you can get, you know, customer loyalty points for using your card and things of that nature. But generally speaking, still the vast majority of day-to-day transactions here are conducted in cash. Even large purchases, I mean, people will still go to a car dealer with, you know, $10,000 equivalent in yen, actual cash to hand over, and, you know, the person there will not bat an eyelash at it. It's quite common for people to use cash for all sorts of transactions here. So it's going to take, I think, a pretty big flip of the switch to get people off of the cash society here. And I don't see the full propaganda press being rolled out yet. But having said that, I think this is a country still under a lot of imperial conditioning, so when, if, and as they really do try to make that big push, I think there will be a lot of people who will jump on board quite quickly.
Right, and when you say a low crime rate, I think perhaps the biggest reason is that it's a country of elderly people. They're not known for knocking off banks.
Generally speaking, yes. It's been a very orderly society for a long time, and there hasn't been a lot of crime, so I think people are just used to that environment and act accordingly. And also, I think it has to do with the fact that there's, I guess, legalized crime. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but of course everyone knows the Japanese mafia controls a large sector of the Japanese economy, and because the mob really is running a lot of the crime, it's crime that they have their mob rules not to attack, you know, civilians, not to rough up people who aren't involved, kind of thing. So it's a strange and uneasy peace relationship between the cops and the mafia here that leads to a somewhat ordered society, at least on the surface, and not a lot of street crime.
Well, fear from somebody or about somebody. The G20 meeting in China on Friday, any chat about that?
That's a good question. I haven't heard a lot of chatter about it. I'm not sure if this is going to be a particularly important meeting. I'm not sure what's on the agenda this time. I think still at this point, internationally speaking, all eyes are on what's happening in Syria at the moment, and I think that might cast a shadow over G20 festivities this time around. But still, I mean, I think there are some pretty important economic factors that are going on internationally that one would expect is being hashed out at some level, whether or not it's at the G20 circus or at something more like the Bank for International Settlements level. There must be a lot of talk between central banks right now about the negative interest rate environment and how that's going to start affecting international markets.
Well, if it hasn't really helped in Japan and hasn't really helped in Europe, why would anybody want to adopt it in the first place?
It's the last tool in the toolbox. There isn't a lot more that can be done in terms of pumping money into the markets because, of course, as we've seen with QE, all that is done is run up the amount of money that's being parked in reserve at the central banks, like the Fed. So once you get to that point, what else can you do to try to get money pumping through the economy other than charging banks for storing it? So I think this is really a sign of desperation on the parts of these central banks, not a sign of strength. And it's really only because there's nowhere else to go. I mean, they can't put rates any lower without going into negative territory, and they can't keep pumping money into the banks because the banks aren't sending it through the economy. So I think it's it's an admission of defeat and an admission that the last several years of QE madness haven't really accomplished what they set out to accomplish. And I really do think it's only a question of time before the Federal Reserve has to admit that their rate hike was in the wrong direction and they start cutting again.
You said a lot of attention on a possible ceasefire in Syria, but even if there is a ceasefire, apparently they still plan to be attacking some groups of people.
Yes, exactly. It's a strange ceasefire, or technically a cessation of hostilities, and it only applies, of course, to the Syrian government and certain parts of the terrorist groups that are attacking the Syrian government, but not all of them. For example, of course, it doesn't apply to ISIS, who you would imagine would not respect such a ceasefire anyway. It doesn't apply to Al-Qaeda in Syria either. And also, there's some weasel words in the UN Security Council resolution that this all rests on as to what actually constitutes the terrorist groups that are exempted from this ceasefire. So there's still confusion about who or what this applies to. And anyway, it doesn't even kick in until Saturday, and we're already seeing an uptick in violence ahead of the ceasefire, as you always do when you have this announced ceasefire. There's going to be more hostility as people jockey for position, so they're in the best position before the ceasefire kicks in. And generally speaking, that often leads to no ceasefire taking place, because people just, by the point that the ceasefire actually arrives, people decide that it's not worth it. So that's a very much a possibility. We already have Turkish President Erdogan coming out and saying he agrees with the idea of a ceasefire in principle, but this is just going to help the Syrian government, so he's not happy with it. And we have the Israeli Prime Minister just coming out today to say that he doesn't believe that this is going to accomplish much, and ultimately he thinks that splitting Syria up into multiple parts is going to be where this is ultimately going to go. So, and Kerry has also floated that. John Kerry has also floated that as the plan B in Syria. So I'm not sure if this ceasefire is even going to take effect, let alone whether it will have any effect.
Has Japan had any benefit from low oil prices, or do they still charge you an arm and a leg for gasoline?
Gasoline prices have dropped, but, you know, as always and as everywhere, not as much as you would expect given the plummeting price of oil. So it has provided a little bit of relief here. Obviously, not just oil, but LNG, of course, the country has been running on largely since the nuclear reactors have been shut down. So this probably does give a bit of a break to cash-strapped corporations here that are trying to cut down on energy costs. But also, with all of the other, you know, negative interest rates and all of that shenanigans, it's pushing up the yen, which, of course, adversely affects all the exporters. So I think net, it isn't really helping the Japanese economy enough, at any rate. But it is it's having a noticeable effect, not a huge effect, but a noticeable effect on the average consumer here.
We'll have more with James Corbett right after the break. Welcome back. We're speaking with James Corbett. Going back to oil and crude, the Saudi oil minister was speaking to oil producers in North America saying there's no way we're going to reduce our production because we know if we cut back, nobody else will. Is that an honest assessment?
Oh, it absolutely is. There was a story a week or two back that there had been some sort of deal, historic deal reached between OPEC and non-OPEC member states for a general cutback in production. And as a result, we saw a little bit of an uptick in the oil prices because everyone thought, oh, okay, it's all under control now. They're going to start cutting back. And within days, that whatever that press release was all about dissolved as country after country came out and said, yeah, well, it doesn't really apply to us. And now with Saudi Arabia confirming it doesn't apply to them, that pretty much is the final nail in the coffin of the idea of such a deal. I don't think we can expect such a deal in the current environment because everyone is pumping as much as they can to get as much market share as they can. And there is no real incentive for anyone to stop doing that. The only way this would work is if everyone abided by it. And of course, I mean, Russia is cash strapped. Saudi Arabia is cash strapped. In Latin America, Venezuela is on its last legs right now. So I don't think any of those states are in a position to start cutting back. And of course, Iran coming online, and they don't want to participate in such a cutback. So I just don't see it as being politically feasible right now. And we are, I still don't see any let up this year in the downward push on oil prices.
Also, there's an admission they want to sell as much oil as they can right now because they expect alternative energy to start pushing out the use of oil.
That's right. We are looking into, it's been estimated, $90 trillion of global energy infrastructure investments over the next 15 years that are largely going to be skewed based on this new post-Paris climate conference reality we're living in, where, of course, it is going to heavily favor green energy investments of various sorts. And that is absolutely going to have an effect on the production and distribution of oil and oil byproducts. So I think that there is a bit of a writing on the wall here, and we see these producer states realizing that, yes, this may be the last gasp to get the full value out of their reserves that they have. And so I think that factors into it. That is a bit of a long game scenario, though. I mean, still, one would expect in the next 10 to 15 years, we'd still be looking mostly at business as usual in the energy sector. But it certainly is something that I think they're looking at for long-term strategy as to how to get the most out of their reserves.
And of course, government revenue, so much of it comes from taxes on gasoline. And you compare the price of driving to work. I pointed out to my wife, if she had an electric car, it would cost her 75 cents to drive out to the University of British Columbia and back home a day. And it's $6 a day using gasoline. So and a lot of that is taxation. So how long would we still have cheap electricity if it's being used for cars?
Well, that's an excellent point, because as has just recently been announced, the Australian government is now looking into the idea of taxing by the mile. Rather than putting in a gasoline tax, they want to track every vehicle and tax by miles driven, rather than by putting that tax in the gasoline. So exactly right. As people switch off gas and into electricity, well, they'll still have a way of taxing that. Don't worry. They're just putting in the infrastructure for that right now. So we're going to see a lot more tracking technology coming online in vehicles in the next decade as a part of this shift over that's taking place. And I think the governments are getting out ahead of it. They know where things are heading. So they realize that if they want to maintain that tax revenue, they're going to have to switch out of taxing the gas and taxing by the mile. And it's already starting to happen in Australia and elsewhere around the world.
And of course, in Vancouver, the toll bridges were expected to pay for themselves, but people have been avoiding them in droves. And now the biggest toll bridge in the world, the Port Man, is losing money, losing millions of dollars a year because people just have not flocked to it for the convenience.
That's right. And that's, that's the free market at work. That's the beauty of it. You can build these huge projects, but if people don't want to pay for them, then it's not going to pay for itself. So, unfortunately, in that situation, when there's been that kind of investment, generally, they'll try to find ways to make people use that, or they will just try to distribute the cost of it around so that people are paying for it, whether they want to or not.
And the technology for tracking you on the Portman isn't all that accurate. I was charged for making 3 trips, 2 one way and 1 the other way, at exactly the same time.
That sounds about right, yeah. No, I think the technology is not where it needs to be for them to even consider doing that, but it's not going to stop them from doing it.
And I've written for a refund. They keep promising me one, but I still haven't received it. So maybe they're counting on the interest from that, unless, of course, there's negative interest rates, in which case they'll return me the cash right away. Zika virus causing a lot of panic, but is there a connection perhaps between microencephaly and the pesticides that are used against mosquitoes?
That idea has been raised. It has been raised by a group of doctors in Brazil that have noted that there is a connection between the areas where this Zika outbreak is now being linked to microcephaly for the first time in history, and where they have been using large amounts of a new larvicide that was introduced to the water supply in that area of Brazil in 2014, this new larvicide was introduced, and lo and behold, about 9 months later, we start having this outbreak of microcephaly, which they are now blaming on Zika virus. There has been no conclusive, definitive link proven, as far as I know, between the pesticide and the outbreak of microcephaly. But then again, there has been no conclusive and definitive link proven between Zika virus and microcephaly. In fact, we are only starting to get the first sign that it's even possible for vertical transmission of Zika virus, i.e. from the mother to the child in utero, crossing the placenta. There hasn't even been any scientific evidence for that until very recently that that's even possible. So we're still a long way from understanding exactly what's happening, but they certainly have not made the case that this microcephaly outbreak is being caused by Zika virus. They have not even yet made the case that there is a microcephaly outbreak that is unusual, because one of the things about this is that it is diagnosed by the head circumference of the baby, which, generally speaking, it's an arbitrary number that they use to decide whether a case is microcephaly or not, and once you start looking for it, you are going to find a lot more cases than you otherwise would. So there is something of that effect going on right now. And just to give an indication of that, there are estimates of anywhere between 800 to 25,000 babies born per year in the United States with microcephaly. I think the wide variance in those estimates should give you an indication of just how little this condition is generally tracked, and just how much more reporting of it we can expect to see when people start looking for it.
And now they've added a little more panic factor to this, saying the Zika virus might be sexually transmitted.
Right, yes, we're starting to see cases of purported sexual transmission of the disease. Now, I think 14 cases or so that in the U.S. that have been reported. But again, as far as I know, that hasn't been confirmed. So a lot of this, unfortunately, is fed by the 24/7 news cycle, which is always looking for what is the latest soundbite that we can use, regardless of whether or not it's proven, regardless of whether or not there's any good science backing it up. Let's just run with it. So a lot of this gets reported, and then people just hear it, you know, read a headline or hear it on a news soundbite and think that it is gospel truth. I think that anyone in the United States or in Canada right now that's freaking out about Zika virus really needs to double check what media sources they're tuning into, and, you know, whether or not those sources can be relied upon, because at this point there is no reason for anyone in those places to be panicking. The only people who need to even be remotely concerned about this right now are in Brazil, where this microcephaly may or may not be taking place, and that's where people should at least be paying attention to this. Right now in the United States, I think it's just freaking out for the sake of generating clicks on websites and things of that nature.
And of course, the big pharmaceutical companies would like to build another vaccine that they can charge you a lot of money for.
Exactly right. Of course, in the wake of the declaration by the CDC that this was a potential, you know, huge hazard for the United States, we saw Obama come out and promise $1.8 billion towards this Zika problem, which was going to go to mosquito eradication and helping poor underprivileged women who are pregnant, and oh yes, also development of a new vaccine. So the U.S. government is going to be pumping in however many billions of dollars into the development of vaccine, which they will then pay the vaccine producers to produce. So it's a win-win for Big Pharma, as always with these types of pandemic emergencies, however real they may or may not be.
James, any more news for us from Japan that we should know about?
I think that pretty much covers the gamut of what I'm looking at right now. The market's obviously in turmoil right now, and there a lot of it's being blamed on oil, but I think there's much deeper structural issues than just oil to be looking at with regards to this. And I think we've seen the top of the dead cat bounce that we saw in the last couple of weeks in the market. So I'm looking for a significant plunge coming from this point, but we'll see what the markets have to say about that, and whether or not gold and other safe haven investments are going to maintain the lift that they've gotten in the last few days.
James, thanks a lot for chatting with us.
Always a pleasure.
My guest has been James Corbett, publisher of thecorbettreport.com. He was speaking to us from Japan. You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio. Find us on Twitter at Talk Digital Net. Our popular YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Comments or questions for the show can be sent to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thanks for listening.